This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in for your usual host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And joining us from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
And Sam Livingston.
Hello.
Well, here in the United States, demands to defund police continue, and many states and cities are actually taking specific actions toward that end. And now here we are a few weeks into this trend, and it's clear that violent crime in many U.S. cities is surging. For this, we'll go to Sam.
This month, the month of June, there was a 130% increase in the number of shooting incidents in the city of New York. That's, like I said, up 130% over the same month last year. There were a total of 205 shootings in the city this month. Burglaries also rose 120%. So this is in a city that just announced it will be cutting its police funding budget by $1 billion. So they've already seen a massive uptick in crimes. And those are just the ones that are reported. In Los Angeles, there's a 250% surge in homicides this year compared to the same time in 2019. That city has also announced that they will be cutting their budget by $150 million. The city of Chicago is generally sees a big uptick in violence in the warmer months of the year. This year, it's been especially high. Just last weekend, there were over 80 shootings and 15 deaths in the city. That was 4th of July weekend. So it's the city of Chicago, sadly, is always very violent. They're not up a tremendous amount over previous years. The amount of shootings are up, but the deaths aren't up as high. So I guess there's some silver lining in that. It's the same story across a lot of Democrat-led cities, Baltimore, Atlanta, Philadelphia. They're seeing similar trends. The Guardian here in the UK, they actually compiled a list of all of the shootings and all of the deaths in the United States over the 4th of July weekend. There were 500 people wounded in shootings and 160 killed. Just for reference, in the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq, the United States lost 82 troops and had 600 wounded. So we're starting to see that play out throughout American cities pretty much every weekend, at least through the month of June. Kansas City has worked out an arrangement with the Department of Justice. They're having federal agents from the FBI, the ATF. They're coming in to help the city's police because they've also had a surge in violence that they are struggling to get under control. President Trump has offered to do that for other cities. Chicago and New York have rejected his offers. And then down in Georgia, the governor just announced that he'll be sending in 1,000 National Guard troops into the city of Atlanta to protect state government buildings. Over the 4th of July weekend, there were pictures of one police precinct that had homemade grenades thrown into it and detonated. So the governor there is just stepping in and saying, we're going to go in and protect our own buildings if the local police aren't going to do it. So that's a brief rundown of last weekend and the surge of violence across U.S. cities.
So, you know, America's police are being just castigated and undermined in all sorts of ways right now. And it's really devastating these cities, as you've pointed out. But can you tell if the COVID-19 outbreak plays any role in this? I know we have millions of Americans who are out of work right now, but still receiving government assistance. So I just wonder if that idle time on the hands of so many is part of what's driving this surge.
Yeah, a lot of mayors have suspected that when you lock everyone up in their homes for 3 months, that there's just a lot of emotion that's building up during that time, and then it's finally starting to ease and everyone's running out of their houses. I mean, generally you see an uptick in violent crime in the springtime anyway, but I think when you factor in the lockdown and the emotional stress that people have been through, and then you add on top of that the Black Lives Matter movement really preying on a lot of that pent-up emotion, it definitely would contribute to a surge in people being out and being a lot more erratic and violent as well.
Well, this is just a really unsettling trend, a really sobering trend. And for me, it calls to mind an article written back in 2015 by Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury. It's called Police Under Attack. Mr. Fleury in that piece just really identified this trend early on, I think, far before it was anywhere near as evident as it is now. And in that piece, he devotes quite a lot of space to exposing just why this is happening, just really getting to the root cause of it all. Could you discuss a little bit of that underpinning reason a little bit?
Yeah, he's written a fair bit about that over the past 4 or 5 years. And like you say, he was ahead of that before this movement really picked up a lot of steam. That issue of the trumpet you mentioned there, it has a police shield on it with a bullet hole through it. He's also written in the latest trumpet about race riots were prophesied. And there was a trumpet cover a few years ago with the image of a car on fire, your cities are burned with fire. So like you say, it's something that he pinpointed a long time ago. You can read about it as well in the Ezekiel booklet. And the tension that is rising in our cities, a lot of it gets back to this racial tension being inflamed by these movements in the United States. And it's, of course, fundamentally, it's an attack on the rule of law and an attack on America's institutions.
Okay, well, we will be sure to include links in our show notes for today's program to Police Under Attack and also Race Riots Were Prophesied, both written by Mr. Gerald Fleury. Thanks very much for that, Sam. So we know that a lot of the violence that Sam just discussed there is the result of groups like Black Lives Matter calling for police to be defunded and even going beyond rhetoric by actually rioting and using violence in some cases. But we've actually seen more and more of what we would think of as mainstream people expressing solidarity with Black Lives Matter and related movements. And this week, a prominent member of Britain's royal family joined in those ranks. To tell us about this, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, Prince Harry basically spoke out in support of Black Lives Matter this week. And in doing so, I think he's gone further towards that than just about anyone else in British politics. I mean, even the main left-wing, the leader of the main left-wing party, Sir Keir Starmer, I mean, he's done the hokey-cokey a bit with Black Lives Matter, supporting them and then not supporting them and then apologizing again. But Prince Harry, it was no apology. It was just a full-throated support from him. So it started with July 1st. He gave a video message on what would have been the 59th birthday of his mother, Diana, Princess of Wales. And you know, it was at an award ceremony, and he was talking about how that racism is endemic in British society, and just, you know, really endorsing this systemic racism message that you hear from Black Lives Matter. He said my wife said recently that our generation and the ones before us haven't done enough to right the wrongs of the past. I too am sorry. And then on Monday, he joined people from across the Commonwealth, but people that you know, very closely associated with this Black Lives Matter ideology. One of the people that he was having this video call with and appearing alongside with is someone who describes herself as a queer black feminist woman and an anti-capitalism advocate. And he got up there and talked about how – well, he brought up the British Commonwealth, and he said, well, we need to acknowledge the past, that there's more to do to right the wrongs of the past. He talked about the institutional systemic racism in the organization. He praised the Black Lives Matter movement. He said, for the first time ever, thanks to the Black Lives Matter movement, he said, this is the moment people are starting to be listened to. So supporting that radical ideology and even leading it to a certain extent. I've not seen anyone until then criticize the British Commonwealth. The British Empire, we've written about that. We've talked about that. There's been a lot of criticism from that left-wing movement on the British Empire and attacking, distorting, erasing the history around the British Empire. But the Commonwealth is different. You know, the Commonwealth is a free association of democratic nations that anyone can join, anyone can leave. The Secretary General is a black woman. Not in the mainstream, at least. It hadn't come under attack.
And it's entirely voluntary, right, for nations to have membership.
Yeah, there are even some nations in the Commonwealth that were never part of the British Empire. They volunteered to join. Hmm. I think you have to be a free democracy to join. But there's no coercion. And I think maybe I refer to it as the British Commonwealth in talking. The technical name is the Commonwealth. It dropped the British to emphasize this free association aspect of it.
So that's really surprising that he would rail against that particular institution. Could you talk a little bit about how the way he discussed the Commonwealth, just how that contrasts with the way his grandmother, the Queen of England, views it?
Yeah, I think that's why this attack is so remarkable, is in a lot of ways the Commonwealth has been the Queen's life work. I mean, if you think about when she lived, the Commonwealth began in, I think, about 1949. And then the Queen's reign began in 1952, but certainly very shortly after the Commonwealth came into existence. So, she, more than any other ruler, more than any other leader, she is the one that helped build up the Commonwealth. And it's something that she has put a real value on. One of the main kind of photographers that follows her around and takes pictures, Arthur Edwards, he wrote an article in The Sun just talking about how much she cherishes the Commonwealth, how much he saw her enjoy those Commonwealth meetings, how that they were especially special to her. He wrote that to criticize the Commonwealth to criticize the one thing the Queen cherishes above all things, which is preserving the Commonwealth, is an insult to her. And she's been really determined about the Commonwealth in the past as well. In 1973, Prime Minister Edward Heath, he tried to block her from coming to the Commonwealth summit and tried to kind of get between the Queen and the Commonwealth and to split her off from it to a certain extent. She came anyway. She came as the Queen of Canada and she put a different hat on and was still found a way to outmaneuver him. So this is something that she has worked very hard for. And when Meghan Markle, even when she got married, she had on her veil, I think it was 49 flowers for the number of countries that were then part of the – a flower for each country that was then part of the Commonwealth. And apparently that gesture was something that was especially touching to the Queen. And so it is a dramatic shift to see them turn against that like that.
So in the Philadelphia Trumpet just a couple of issues back, you wrote an article called Royal Family Divides Britain, just a really powerful piece there that I think did a great job of showing that a real turning point is underway in Britain's race relations. Would you be able to talk about that a little bit and then just place all of this in the context of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, so the throne was something that once united Britain. Britain is Britain because of the throne. That's what brought England and Scotland together after centuries of warfare. And what you're seeing now is this, especially with Prince Harry and his wife, they are really taking a lead in bringing division and bringing this this racial division into Britain. And so in that article, I talked about how when Harry and Meghan announced that they were leaving Britain, there was a lot of press saying, well, it's because Britain is racist. If you don't like Meghan Markle, it's because you're racist. This is the only reason she's been criticized and she's leaving, because the royal family is racist and we're a fundamentally racist institution. And I think it was the most divisive discussion we have ever had here in Britain on race until this point. And now with that discussion getting even more divisive, they're getting back in on that. And you're seeing this institution that should unite Britain playing a major role in dividing the country. And we've been talking about some important changes that have been happening within that throne in Britain. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has written a landmark articles and book on some very significant changes going on in that family. He wrote all the way back in September 2017 that the royal family was going into rapid decline. And he talked about the fact that God is changing the way that he's been dealing with that family. And he wrote that in 2017. And just look at the changes and the decline that we've seen since then. Just so many news stories have come out since that time that have really proven that true. From all the way from Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein to some of these royal divorces, and then most especially all of this turmoil with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle that has really been, I think, the biggest crisis since the abdication crisis prior to World War II for the royal family. So you're seeing a very significant shift after he wrote that article. And to understand why, to understand what is going on behind there, what God's role is with Britain's royal family, why God has prophecies about royalty, you really need to read our book, The New Throne of David, that Mr. Flory wrote at that time. And that will explain that change. That will explain what is happening in Britain. It will also explain what a royal family should do, how a royal family can bring a nation, bring a people, even bring the world together, and what God's plans for that are as well.
We'll be sure to include links there to Richard's article, Royal Family Divides Britain, and also Mr. Flurry's book, The New Throne of David. Thanks very much for that, Richard. We'd like to move over now to the Middle East, where there's been just a whole spate of mysterious explosions in Iran. For this, we'll go to Brent.
Yeah, we've been talking about these, I think, for the last couple of weeks, but they continue. And the most recent one took place Thursday evening, Friday morning. So just in the last 24 hours, there was another explosion outside Tehran. This one looks to have taken place near a facility of the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. There's still murky details coming in about that one, but that would be the seventh in the past 2 weeks that have happened in and around Tehran. Two of the confirmed areas that have been hit so far is a place that was used in the production of solid propellant for ballistic missiles. This is something that Israel obviously doesn't want Iran to have, this technology, to then give it to its proxies to then fire upon Israel. Israel has been firing upon convoys and facilities in Syria and Lebanon that have precision-guided missiles that have been built and constructed inside Iran. And so Israel has said that they would attack at the source if they had to, and perhaps this factory where the attack two weeks ago took place was at the factory that was producing these. Then the more significant attack took place last Friday morning, and this was at the Natanz facility. This is a place that is responsible for the purification or the enrichment of uranium to weapons-grade uranium. This is an area that was heavily talked about in the Iran nuclear deal, and this was attacked by a bomb, it looks like, from people are reporting, New York Times reported on an Israeli source that it came from the inside, meaning that an explosive made its way into the facility rather than being attacked by the air. And then it blew up the main assembly chamber for these centrifuges, these advanced centrifuges that Iran is not meant to have and not meant to be working on as per the nuclear deal. But 2 years ago, they started that up again. And these David Albright, who is one of the most world-renowned nuclear experts, was all heavily involved in 2 decades of work for the IAEA. He came out and said about a two-thirds or three-quarters of the factory that actually assembles these centrifuges that produce or enrich uranium at a far greater pace than the slower, like generation one or two centrifuges, that so much of this building was destroyed that it would have set back the nuclear program of Iran by a few months or even a year. And so this was a very significant attack. This is not normally a location that would typically, because it was in the assembly hall of where these were assembled, that it was likely not an inadvertent explosion that caused it, but it was probably the result of a direct attack. And given the fact that we've had so many of these random attacks over the past 2 weeks, people are looking to Israel as being the accomplice or being behind these attacks, whether they use agents inside Iran or not. And really does point to a worrying stage where we're at with Iran's nuclear program, that that Israel would reach out to this level of direct attack on Iranian soil to try and slow down the nuclear program.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was about to ask about. I know that for the last number of years, we've heard that Iran is just a short time away from having viable nuclear weapons. So I just wonder if this spate of attacks, do you think that this gives us any clear indication of where exactly Iran is in its pursuit of nuclear weapons?
Well, it really does depend on whether they're producing it entirely by themselves or getting help from the North Koreans or something like that. But if they are producing it entirely by themselves, perhaps this does set them back a couple of months. Remember that Iran was only at this, let's say, 2 weeks ago before this attack. And again, this is just based on satellite imagery that it's set it back by a couple of months or longer. So we don't know that. No one in Iran is telling us how long it set back their nuclear program. But before this, they were only about 4 months away from having the weapons grade uranium needed for a nuclear weapon. Now, we are unsure right now about how they have, whether they've produced the detonator, the initial reaction that's needed to produce a nuclear weapon to allow the rest of the nuclear bomb to go on. We are unaware if they have fully the weapons delivery system, the ballistic missiles that can send it across to Israel, Europe, or elsewhere, though they have produced technology that could be used if they can fire a satellite into orbit, then they can have that technology for a nuclear weapon. So there are a lot of unknowns. And this, again, goes back to the failure of the nuclear deal, which only set back that Iran's nuclear program, its breakout, by a year. That's what they said. Let's keep it for a year. Then after 10 years, you can do what you want. And for the past 2 years, we know, based on what Iran has told us themselves, and which is confirmed by IAEA inspectors, that they have broken every part of the nuclear deal. That we know, based on what they've said, that they're only a few months away from having the weapons-grade uranium to use a nuclear weapon. But I think the fact that Israel is attacking and risking counterattack, you've got to understand that Iran doesn't want its nuclear program destroyed, and that it has plenty of assets that are willing to fire upon Israel. 100,000 missiles sitting up just north of Israel's border under Hezbollah's control. Many of them precision-guided, can hit anywhere in Israel within a meter. So there is a lot that Israel has to weigh if they're going to try and start taking out Iranian assets like this in Iranian territory proper. And no prime minister is going to do that if Iran isn't close. Again, Israel only acts in this way out of self-defense. It's not claiming responsibility for these attacks. There's no sort of bravado in these attacks. These are actual self-defensive moves that Israel is making because it feels extremely threatened by Iran's moves towards nuclear bomb.
So with most countries, nuclear weapons are really intended mainly as a deterrent. You know, the leaders of those countries, as power hungry as they might be, hope to never use their nuclear arsenals because they know that there would very likely be retaliation against them with nuclear weapons from other nations. So nuclear weapons have actually played a kind of a considerable role in preventing major powers from open war against each other over the last seven decades or so. But in Iran, we have evidence that the thinking there is entirely different. Could you talk a little bit about that and just place it in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Well, there's two things that you have to bring out here. And one is, people will say that, you know, mutually assured destruction takes place, is inside Iran's rationale, meaning even if they had the bomb, they wouldn't use it because they would know that we would destroy them as well. Well, it's really hard to use that with in terms of Israel, because in just without talking about, as we'll get to point two, the fanatical nature of the Islamic regime, but Israel is a very small country. It's really hard to counterstrike a nuclear attack on Israel because of the size of its country. And it doesn't take much for Israel to be destroyed as with a few well-placed nuclear weapons. So it is hard to argue that. It also is very scary giving the leading terrorist sponsoring nation a nuclear weapon, because they then start acting with absolute impunity with their more conventional arms. What happens if Iran has a nuclear weapon? They start firing 100,000 missiles down on Israel. Israel starts attacking and Iran says, back off, or we're going to use our nuclear weapon. And so they can get away with a whole lot more short of nuclear weapons if they get one. So that's another point to consider as well. But again, when it gets to the Islamic regime in Iran, they have said that the Ayatollah has said that his number one goal is to destroy Israel. It doesn't matter, according to their many of the leadership's fanatical ideals, whether Iran does survive a nuclear strike or not. It is their goal. Of course, they would like to win, but it's their goal to produce the worldwide chaos that will bring about the return of their Messiah. And so they are not limited by what you would consider rational thinking about self-preservation in this regard. That might sound crazy to people, but it's what they believe, it's what they write. And so when somebody's building a nuclear weapon, you should take them at their word, and the Israelis do take them at their word. There's a number of things that people can read on this. I think the best thing that I would think that people should read is a chapter from Great Again by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry. It's chapter 6 of that book, and it's entitled, I think it's The Biggest Lie in History, and it's all about the nuclear deal and how President Obama allowed the nuclear deal to go through and why he did and how it wasn't actually an act of naivety or ignorance that this would actually compel Iran to not get a nuclear weapon, but that it was actually the process by which they would receive one.
We'll include a link to Great Again, Chapter 6, and Brent also has an article up at thetrumpet.com right now. It's called Mysterious Explosions Expose Iran's Continued Nuclear Ambition. So we'll link to that as well. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, we spoke on the show over the last couple of episodes, actually, about the landmark national security law that China has imposed on Hong Kong, and about the way this just flagrantly violates the one country, two systems agreement between China and Hong Kong. And now the dust is beginning to settle on this terrifying new reality there, and many nations of the world are starting to weigh in on it and to actually express their support for China's power grab. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, this new security law is really revealing which nations are supporting China and which nations are supporting other powers on the world scene. Right shortly after they passed this new security law on June 3rd, there was a vote taken at the United Nations with one side led by Britain condemning China's crackdown on Hong Kong, and another side led by Cuba supporting it. Now, at the time, the general public didn't know much more than Britain was leading the move to condemn it, and Cuba was leading the move to support it. But the news agency Axios finally last Friday got a list of the nations that lined up on each side. And there were 27 nations with Britain, most of them being Commonwealth nations or nations in the European Union, condemning this crackdown in Hong Kong. But there were 53 nations, about one out of four on the planet, that lined up with Cuba. Most of them were in Africa and the Middle East, and some of them are what you could expect, dictatorships like North Korea and Syria. But there's also quite a few nations in the, like, Caribbean nations in the Western Hemisphere, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Suriname, some of the smaller island nations in the Caribbean. And this, the vote, it's significant in the fact that it kind of shows some fault lines as to which nations, because voting for a UN resolution to support what China does to Hong Kong, it doesn't really help your domestic policies much. It's basically a way to show China that you support them, even if supporting them means upsetting Britain or the United States or other Western powers.
So many of these nations that you mentioned that support China, Cuba, you know, Nicaragua, those countries in the Middle East, they're actually located near strategic maritime locations. Could you talk a little bit about that important aspect of this and just how that connects it to Bible prophecy?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the big reasons that we're interested in it, as we've talked on this program quite a bit before about different prophecies. One in Isaiah 23 that talks about like this economic mart of nations that lines up against the United States, and one of the leaders of that mart of nations being Kittim, which is an ancient name for China. But then also in Deuteronomy 28 about this this promise that God made ancient Israel that if they disobeyed him, he'd take away, they'd be besieged in all their gates. And so that's kind of, it's adding a layer of detail to the Isaiah 23 prophecy about how this mart of nations is going to besiege the end time descendants of Israel, America and Britain. They use the gates. Now, in planetary terms, a gate is not just a door to a city, but it's actually like a maritime choke point, like places that like are vital for oil trade, the Straits of Hormuz, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the straits, the Panama Canal, these straits that go on either side of the island of Cuba and the Caribbean. And it is true that if you it's unfortunate I can't show maps on the radio, but if you were to actually see a map of the nations that supported this resolution, supporting China for this crackdown in Hong Kong, I mean, you're looking at Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela. These are all located very close to important shipping lanes to the United States. And then these Middle Eastern nations are all clustered around the Straits of Hormuz and the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb. And so you'll see that these nations that are supporting China, even at the expense of upsetting the United States and Britain, are located along these maritime choke points. And so you're already seeing here this this mart of nations developing. I guess the big piece of the puzzle missing when you look at that map is that Isaiah 23 prophecy also talks about Tyre, which is a prophetic name for the superstate rising in Europe. And so you'll see that like Germany and most of the European nations are still taking the U.S.-British side in this dispute and not lining up with China. But China is definitely already making close relationships with the nations around these sea gates that would be needed to conduct a siege like the one prophesied in Isaiah.
Andrew has written an article called Preparing to Storm America's Castle that really lays out these Bible prophecies and places them in the context of the current events that we see happening. So please check that out in the show notes for today's episode. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories that we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be there soon, along with links to the various pieces of literature that we've mentioned. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more about these important stories. Coming up, we'll talk about Germany's turn at the helm of the European Union, deepening fear of a Chinese invasion in Taiwan, American Jews versus Israeli Jews, and a major ruling by America's Supreme Court against the state of Oklahoma. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In Europe, for the first time in 13 years, Germany is temporary head of the European Council. To tell us about the significance of this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yes, on July 1st, Germany began its six-month rotating presidency of the European Council. So we've reached the stage where two out of Europe's 3 to 5 presidents, depending on how you count them, are German. The European Commission president is Ursula von der Leyen, the former German defense minister. And then it's not just these figures either. You start to look at the mid-level officials. I don't know, you could call it the European Union deep state. Really the whole European Union is very like that. But there's a lot of key German officials there. Politico had an article a couple of weeks ago. It was called "We'll All Be Speaking German Soon," just about how many people around the European Union were taking German lessons, because if you want to get anything, because that was becoming kind of the de facto language of European power. So, you know, Germany, I think their power in Europe does not rest on the fact that they're holding this rotating presidency for 6 months. But at the same time, it does shine a spotlight on a power that is already there. And it's an interesting time period. It's a time of crisis for Germany. We had Trumpet editor-in-chief a couple of months ago wrote an article called "Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire." And it was, I think it was on the cover of our Trumpet print. And he was writing about, well, one of the big things to watch for the coronavirus is watch for that to cause a crisis in Europe. Watch for that to change Europe's direction, to force Europe to make some significant changes. And so right at that time, well, we see Germany in the driver's seat, Germany holding that rotating presidency. And like I said, even if a major crisis doesn't develop within this next six months, really, you've got a lot of German power within Europe.
So we've seen over the last several months and years, really, the EU's relationship with the United States just becoming more and more strained. Do you think that Germany being at the head of the European Council will have any effect on that?
It's certainly not going to make it better. I mean, you look at what Angela Merkel has been saying, even just in recent days. I think it was yesterday she had a comment that was a pretty thinly veiled criticism of President Trump's handling of the coronavirus. And you know, there's a lot in Europe that are kind of putting out this narrative, the same narrative that you see on CNN, that you know, we've handled the coronavirus brilliantly and America's handled it incompetently. In some ways, you just kind of marvel at how well Europe has done and Germany has done of getting this narrative across. And someone was making the point, I think it was Politico, again, just look at China. If you look at what nation is doing the most evil in the world right now, I think there's a pretty strong case that it's China. I mean, maybe North Korea, and there are other countries that have great potential to do evil, you know, Iran with a nuclear bomb. But in terms of what they're actually doing, you know, you've got China with, you know, just ending democracy in Hong Kong, the ethnic cleansing going on with the Uyghurs there. Yet the European Union has this kind of image where Donald Trump and America, they are selfish and they're self-interested and they only look out for themselves. But we Europeans, we are good and we are altruistic and we have the whole world in mind. Yet you look at how these different nations are dealing with this evil regime in China, and Donald Trump and America is the one standing up to China, while Germany is the one saying, well, actually, we're not going to criticize their national security law and we're not going to criticize their treatment of the Uyghurs because we do a lot of business with them. You know, they're the ones that, by any objective standard, are acting much more selfishly. But there is this Trumpet editor-in-chief, Brad McDonald, it was a cover article, I think, in the latest Trumpet print, on just how they're doing such a great job of leading the world, really, in this anti-American this anti-American push. And so, yeah, that's certainly not going to go away.
Yeah, it really is strange, especially given the way Germany in the post-war era has tried to really paint itself as this defender of human rights to atone for its sins with the Holocaust. But now suddenly they refuse to really condemn China, where there is in many ways another Holocaust happening in real time right now. So it's a strange development there. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Sure. So in 1952, Herbert W. Armstrong, he wrote in The Plain Truth, "The United States is determined now to let nothing stand in the way of building up a rearmed, independent Germany. This will be the heart and core of the united Europe that will revive the Holy Roman Empire." And there's a clip that we, at one point, we kind of played so much on the Trumpet Daily radio show, it became a bit of a running joke between Sam and I about Mr. Armstrong talking about, well, Europe can't rise without its heart, and its heart is in Germany. And we played that a lot because it's so relevant to what you see in Europe. Germany is the most dynamic economy in Europe. It's got the largest population. Mr. Armstrong saw, you have a European Union, Germany is going to inevitably end up leading that. But he saw that not just because of efficient news analysis. He was basing that off Bible prophecy. There are very specific prophecies that talk about a power that's going to rise within Europe. And there are other prophecies that talk about Assyria rising in Europe, and Assyria being this major power. And we have other articles that prove that, but you can look through history and you can look through Bible prophecy and you can see Assyria is referring to Germany. So you've got these prophecies of a united European power made up of 10 kings rising. You have these prophecies that talk about that power in terms of Assyria. The logical deduction is, well, Assyria is the leader of that united power. So Mr. Armstrong made that forecast based on Bible prophecy, and he made it at a time, maybe it seems obvious that Germany would leave Europe now. It didn't seem obvious in 1945 and 1946, those times when Mr. Armstrong was making that forecast, but he was able to make that because of Bible prophecy. And you can learn more about that and get this sure forecast for your future. We've got a whole number of books, but Germany and the Holy Roman Empire is a particularly relevant one to this subject.
We will include a link to Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. And also, we have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called Germany Rules Europe by Josue Michels. So we'll include links to both of those. Thanks very much for that, Richard. Well, in the first half, we spoke about China's imposition of just a really draconian security law on Hong Kong and the way the nations of the world are reacting to that. And there's one country that is fearing more and more that what happened to Hong Kong could soon happen to them. For this story, we'll go back to Andrew.
The island of Taiwan was one of the countries that agreed to accept asylum seekers from Hong Kong. Although any Hong Kongers who are able to escape and make it to Taiwan, unfortunately, may not actually have by themselves much more time. Foreign Affairs had an article this week entitled, "Is Taiwan the Next Hong Kong?" where it just really delves into some of the explanations of like the ripple effects of the United States' reaction to this crisis in Hong Kong, or rather the United States' lack of reaction. Saying that now, yesterday, the U.S. government, they did sanction three senior Chinese officials over what they did to Hong Kong, but all things considered, that's kind of a slap on the wrist. And this Foreign Affairs article made the point that they're like, really, if you look at other precedents, Vladimir Putin, I mean, he invaded Georgia in 2008, and then he got away with it. And that really encouraged him to invade Crimea a few years later, and said, you're kind of seeing the same thing, or possibly the same thing, play out here, where China, they had this one country, two systems deal with Hong Kong. They totally broke it. They forced it into the communist mold. So far, it looks like there haven't really been any repercussions for that. And so that really could encourage them to do the same thing in Taiwan.
And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has said that the days of Taiwan's freedom are numbered. So this Foreign Affairs piece really really confirms what he has forecast about that.
Right. Foreign Affairs is writing about it this week because of what actually happened in Hong Kong over the course of the last month. But yeah, we're definitely interested in it because, yeah, Mr. Fleury, he's got an article titled Taiwan Betrayal that he wrote all the way back in August 1998, where he's got the statement in there. He said, how could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become part of mainland China? These 21 million people are going to be forced into the Chinese mold, and it's going to happen for one reason. because of a pitifully weak-willed America. And earlier in that article, he cites a prophecy in Leviticus 26 and verse 19 about God breaking the pride of America's power. This article was written in the context of a 1998 President Bill Clinton at the time became the first U.S. president to refuse to support Hong Kong's independence bid. He refused to acknowledge that Taiwan was an independent nation from China. And then that was like the writing on the wall showing that without American support, the country's days are numbered. And President Trump's been a little more supportive of Taiwan than his predecessor, President Obama, but definitely not enough to give the Taiwanese much peace of mind, especially looking at the lack of U.S. reaction so far over what just happened to Hong Kong. A lot of them are worried they're going to be next.
Yeah, well, there's a lot for us to keep a close eye on there, and we will include a link to Taiwan Betrayal by Mr. Gerald Fleury in the show notes. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. For the next story, we'll come back to the United States here, where many among the Jewish population are growing less and less supportive of the idea of the State of Israel as a Jewish state. For this, we'll go back to Brent.
Yeah, this whole idea finally made it to the New York Times op-ed page, which is kind of a place where these radical leftist ideas are pushed, and they're pushed upon a public and thought to be give them credence to make them think that they're normal or that they are espoused by large numbers of people. And there was one that took place or that was written on I think it was Wednesday. It was written by Peter Beinart, and he wrote a larger piece along a similar topic. In I think the Jewish a Jewish publication of some sort. His title is "I No Longer Believe in a Jewish State," and he is an American Jew. He's writing from that perspective, of course. And his piece basically says that a two-state solution is no longer viable because of Israel, and puts the blame fully on Israel for not allowing that. And then he says this, quote, "It's time to abandon the traditional two-state solution, embrace the goal of equal rights for Jews and Palestinians. It's time to imagine a Jewish home that's not a Jewish state." So what he's saying is get rid of all the borders, all the people that are right there right now is what the nation should be. It will be purely democratic rule, and whatever the majority wants is what the majority gets, regardless of the foundational documents of the State of Israel or its basic laws. And of course, Israel has written in its independence declaration that it is a Jewish state and that it's the homeland for the Jewish people, as well as being a Jewish state, just like you would have the Islamic Republic of Iran. A lot of the European nations are in their title, the Christian country or Christian nation or whatever. Israel's a Jewish state. It was founded with that premise. It was founded as the homeland, but also a place where the Jews could flourish, where the Jews could go for safety from recurrent pogroms against them, not just World War II, but that's been the norm for history. And this here, we've got an American Jew that comes along and says, well, two-state solution hasn't worked. It's Israel's fault. And so now Israel just has to accept that it is no longer going to be Jewish as a fundamental. It now can be whatever the majority wills, which would be an announcing of the end of the Jewish state, which you would then have. Israel already does have Palestinians inside the Knesset, but one of the rules of joining the Knesset is you have to not be against the Jewish nature of the Jewish state, because that's what it is, or else it would just become another Arab state. There's plenty of those around in the neighborhood. And so what you're seeing here in this New York Times piece is really the culmination, I would say, of thought amongst radical leftists in America that are also Jews, that are more loyal to their ideology over their loyalty to their Jewish brothers and sisters back in Israel. And you have to look at this, and even plenty of people that came out and talked against this spoke about in the same terms as what you see with America right now, with a lot of people inside the United States, a lot of white Americans that are there for the pulling down of statues and the pulling down of the history of the founders of the United States. You have a similar sort of phenomena taking place with American Jews for Israel, and also, sadly, some Jews within Israel as well that are going to be starting to call for this. And now that the New York Times has released this piece, I think the call becomes louder for the wiping out, in some ways, of the Jewish character of the Jewish state of Israel.
Just very briefly, is there any literature you would recommend to listeners who would like to know more about this?
Yeah, there certainly is. There's an article written by Brad McDonald entitled "The Prophecy That Explains the World." While it is mainly about the United States, it really does underpin the spiritual significance of what's going on with the hatred for America, its founders, its founding principles, and even the president, because it exists in the same way for the state of Israel as well.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. We'll be sure to include a link to The Prophecy That Explains the World. For our final story today, we will stay here in the U.S. for a development that hits really close to home for us here in Edmond, Oklahoma. For this, we'll turn it back over to Sam.
Thanks again. The Supreme Court yesterday ruled 5-4 that the state of Oklahoma cannot prosecute Native Americans that live pretty much anywhere in eastern Oklahoma. So a lot of people are scratching their heads over this decision. We were over here as well trying to figure out what this practically means. We now have two sets of laws, a two-tiered system of justice, essentially, in the state of Oklahoma. Neil Gorsuch, he is supposed to be a conservative judge on the court. He's Antonin Scalia's replacement. He was the tiebreaker here. He sided with the majority, and he wrote the majority opinion. Like I said, we were trying to figure out what is the agenda behind this. Ultimately, what this decision does is, aside from stoking a lot of chaos, it creates a lot of division and is part of this movement that we're seeing across the United States to, well, return quote-unquote stolen land to Native Americans, to really undo a lot of U.S. history. This decision affects 19 million acres of land in eastern Oklahoma. It encompasses almost the entire city of Tulsa and would affect about 2 million people that live there. Just a brief summary of this case. It's titled McGirt versus Oklahoma. McGirt, he's of Native American descent. In 1997, he was sentenced to 1,000 years in prison, and I don't want to take the time to get into his horrendous crime. He has since sued the state of Oklahoma, saying that the crime he committed was on an Indian reservation and that the state had no jurisdiction to prosecute him. Shockingly, the Supreme Court agreed with him. So a lot of people, like I said, are scratching their heads. What does this mean now? Does the federal government need to come in and retry his case? What does that mean for over 113 years of history where the state of Oklahoma prosecuted Native Americans that live within the state of Oklahoma? When raised, all of these questions are raised, Gorsuch, in his majority opinion, writes, "Oklahoma and its tribes have proven time and again that they can work successfully together as partners." So he essentially just says, figure it out amongst yourselves. The implications of this are, well, if there's a different set of rules for Native Americans in this area, do they need to pay state taxes? What about if they're on a toll road and they're in their own territory? They can't be charged for or criminally prosecuted for crimes that they commit. How does the federal government set up the resources to come into the state of Oklahoma to try all of these cases? Again, it just creates chaos that doesn't need to be there. Like I said, the state of Oklahoma, it became a state in 1907. For 113 years, this has not been an issue that was even raised by the members of these tribes. They all willingly admitted that they are part of the state of Oklahoma. No other criminal has raised this issue. So suddenly the Supreme Court walks in here and decides that they do need to be treated differently. If you have time, the dissent is really an interesting history of Oklahoma over the past 150 years. Gorsuch says he's upholding a rule that Congress passed back in 1866 or 1832, and then he goes on to ignore 150 years of Congress making further decisions, chiefly the one to create the state of Oklahoma. So he's not really upholding what Congress passed. He's ignoring a lot of that history. I thought it was interesting that this this agreement that the Union made with these tribes in eastern Oklahoma, it was nullified after the Civil War because these tribes owned 8,000 slaves and they sided with the Confederacy and also gave them troops to fight in the Civil War. And essentially after that point, the government said, well, you're not going to get your own territory anymore. And then you go on from there about 50 years of back and forth. Finally, Congress says, we're creating the state of Oklahoma. It's one law for all. And now the Supreme Court has undone 113 plus years of precedent over something that really did not even need to be done. As far as where this fits into Bible prophecy, I think there's a lot that we've mentioned about the Supreme Court. And just the last two or three weeks, the justices have just really seemed to have gone rogue, some of them at least. We pointed last week to Mr. Gerald Fleury's article about the Supreme Court and Bible prophecy. I also thought another one that would be good to look at is Mr. McDonald's article in the July Trumpet titled "The Global Ambition to Destroy America and Its President." And that, I think, explains well the attempt to blot out America's history. A lot of these events that they're going back and looking at are happening in the, you know, the 18th and 19th century, right around the time the birthright promises are being fulfilled. And they're attempting to undo a lot of that history. And Mr. McDonald explains that in the second half of that article.
Well, that is a really concerning development that's sure to just introduce a lot of chaos into the system, as you said. We really appreciate you filling us in on that, Sam. And that brings us to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember to visit us at thetrumpet.com to read more about the stories that we're discussing today. Please email any questions or comments you may have about today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Sam Livingston. And we'll leave you today with the words of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Anything you add to the truth takes away from the truth. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.